In this hour, like I said, it's going to be in every Tuesday, hour two here on the show, our edition of the Inside Scoop. I'll tell you a bit about Mark Levine, if you don't know him, former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank and the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees. He currently hosts, as I said, the Washington-based radio television talk show, The Inside Scoop. That's the title of this hour every Tuesday on the Leslie Marshall Show, and the Raucous Caucus on Pacifica Radio, WPFW 89.3 FM, there in the Beltway. Frequently, you've seen him on TV, appearing on Fox, MSNBC, CNN, Fox Business, and CNBC, tangling with everyone from Bill O'Reilly on the right to his Pacifica co-host on the left. And guys, just let me know when we've got him. In this hour, like I said, you can join us. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543 is the number. And in addition to that, like I said, you can email lesliemarshallshow.com and send an email through there that we can share. You can also follow me on Twitter at Leslie Marshall to tweet me during the show and this hour. And if you want to tweet Mark during this hour to mention some stuff, go to at Mark Levine Talk and follow him there as well. His website, marklevinetalk.com. That's M-A-R-K-L-E-V-I-N-E Talk, T-A-L-K, .com. But like I said, in this hour, we have him joining us here. And Mark, how you doing? Welcome back.
I hear you. Do you hear me?
I've been hearing you the whole time. You just haven't been hearing me.
Oh, okay.
I've been hearing you the whole time. You know, Mark, last week we got to talk not only on the Inside Scoop, but you were on as a guest as well the day the Supreme Court ruling made a very, very prominent decision with regard to, and the ruling regarding a portion of the Defense of Marriage Act, and of course, California's Prop 8, which has been considered unconstitutional, and that definitely is music to the ears of many people, and not just gay Americans, and not just in the state of California, but obviously throughout the country. Now, Mark, we talked last week, and you know, have shared on the program before how you are a gay man, and as an attorney, and a talk show host, this ruling meant a lot to you personally, professionally. But I know that you have a bombshell. I want to talk about something we didn't get to last week. Just briefly, because we have so many other things as well to talk about as well. But let's talk about marriage equality, because obviously marriage is still defined between a man and a woman. Marriage is not truly equal when you can't get married in all 50 states, and when that
right.
definition is still between a man and a woman. So should we start with your bombshell, or should we leave that for a little bit later in
I think we could start with it. I have to give a little bit of context for people to understand that I'm not just gay and a lawyer and a talk show host, but I'm an activist, and I have been working on this for many, many years, including at a time when it was considered crazy. And that's part of what I wanted to point out, how far we've come. To understand how far we've come, you have to understand where we were. So as recently as 1999, which was only 14 years ago, it wasn't that long ago, I and three other people in California founded Marriage Equality California. And at that time, there was not a single state in the United States, nor, in fact, a country on the planet that allowed same-sex marriage. The Netherlands first allowed it in 2000, so I was a few months before that. There had been some discussion. Of course, Hawaii had a case that would have allowed it, except that it was overturned by the voters back in the 1990s. And, of course, there was the Defense of Marriage Act. But I and three others, was actually another gay man, a straight guy, and a lesbian woman, the four of us, began the Valentine's Day protests that still, I think, occur. I'm not sure if they do now that California has marriage equality, but we went in on February 14th, and a bunch of people tried to get married, a bunch of same-sex couples, and they were all denied, and we started that then. And we did that mostly because Californians will remember that in 2000, there was something called the Knight Initiative. It later became Proposition 22, and that was a law by Pete Knight, who was a Republican California state legislator, who didn't like that his son was gay. And he decided to basically take away marriage equality for all Californians, a really horrible thing, I think, for a father to do, particularly given his son. But what he did was, even though it was already prohibited by California law, they went in and they put in an additional prohibition to say that California wouldn't recognize other states. And so forth. Anyway, to get to my bombshell, after Proposition 22 passed, and a lot of people were very upset by that, certainly in the gay community and people who care about gay, lesbian people in their lives. I decided to work with another California lawyer by the name of Jim Toledano to pass the greatest civil unions bill you've ever seen. If California was going to prohibit marriage, I was going to make sure that gay and lesbian couples could at least have civil unions and have full rights and equal rights under the law. They just couldn't call it marriage. So I worked hard. I got a legislature by the name of Paul Koretz, helped get him elected in the Democratic primary and the election. And Paul made me a promise. He said that if he indeed made it to the California Assembly, and he represented West Hollywood, he had a large gay, number of supporters. He's a straight guy, but he had he was certainly supportive of gay equal rights. He said that he would put forward my bill, Jim and my bill, as his first bill in the legislature. So we made that deal. It was a good deal, and I worked very, very hard to get Paul Koretz elected, and he got elected, and I drafted the bill, and lo and behold, history will show that the very first civil unions bill outside of Vermont was the first, California was the second, was the bill that I and a fellow California lawyer drafted to give full and complete equality for gay and lesbian couples. We were just going to call it civil unions and not marriage. But the bombshell as to what happened after that, I don't know if you want to take a commercial break, Leslie, or should I forge right ahead?
I think we can keep going for a few minutes.
Okay, then I'll do that. So what happened was this, and it was very surprising. So Paul Koretz put the civil unions bill in the legislature, and, you know, we expected that it probably wouldn't pass full equality. We might have to compromise a bit. We felt that if we could get full equality, that, you know, if that only gave us 40% of the vote, then maybe we'd have to compromise down and only take half equality or something like that. But what really surprised me is when Paul Koretz gave me a call soon after he introduced the bill, telling me he was going to unintroduce it. He was going to withdraw it. And I said, well, why would you do that? I knew he was a terrific ally. He said, because Lambda Legal Defense Fund, which is the gay civil rights fund, it's like the NAACP for gay people. They're the people that do court cases to protect gay rights. They were insisting that the bill be withdrawn. And I said, well, why would the premier gay rights organization insist that a bill that gave full equality to gay and lesbian couples be withdrawn? And Paul told me, confided to me, that he felt, well, they didn't write the bill. And they get a lot of money from people who give them money because of all the work that they've done promoting gay rights. And the fact that some lawyer and I, two lawyers in California, had written a bill without Lambda's help, that they couldn't stand behind it. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. We should all be on the same side. We should all be working to promote gay equality. And he said, well, you'll have to talk to them because they're a big supporter, and their endorsement means a lot, and it gets me a lot of votes. And I said, I understood. So I picked up the phone and I called Jenny Fizer, who's still, I believe, with the Lambda Legal Defense Fund, and I asked her why she wanted to withdraw the bill. And she said, well, you know, the bill, it's full equality, and we don't think Californians are ready for that. And I said, but you're the gay rights organization. You would think that this is something that you would support. Well, of course we support it, but we just don't think California's ready for that. And I said, well, who's going to be on the forefront of the gay rights movement if it's not gay rights organizations? Anyway, she wouldn't agree with me. She insisted the bill be withdrawn. It was withdrawn. In return, Lambda drafted its own bill that of the 1,000 civil rights that it provided in marriage under California law, Lambda's bill provided 6. And so gay people got 6 rights rather than the 1,000. I actually included 1,000 under state law and 1,000 under federal law. But I say this story mostly so people understand that rights organizations, and I've heard this story or a similar version of it from all kinds of groups, liberal and conservative, environmental groups, civil rights groups, a lot of groups are there for good reasons. And once they get there, they want to raise money, and they want people to know that they're in the forefront of things. So when activists who don't act within their way of doing things get involved, a lot of times they have to shut them down, even if it means harming the very people they were supposed to help. So I tell this story sort of as a cautionary tale to remember that grassroots activism has tremendous power, and if an organization that you support isn't doing what you want it to do, sometimes you have to act outside it.
Very true, and very interesting. And I don't think people realize how much work goes involved. As a straight person, I didn't know I had 1,000 rights. I probably don't, or at least Edward Snowden will tell me that, right? Mark Levine is my co-host in this hour. We are co-hosting the Inside Scoop here on the Leslie Marshall Show. Hour two every Tuesday. You want to join us? Well, pick up the phone and do so. 888-6-LESLIE. 888-653-7543. Follow me on Twitter at Leslie Marshall. Follow Mark at Mark Levine Talk. Quick break. We'll be back. We're going to be switching gears. We got a lot of stuff to talk about with my co-host in this hour on The Inside Scoop every Tuesday. Hour two. Be sure to stick around. And we're back. Leslie Marshall here. Welcome or welcome back. Only true democracy in talk radio of for and by you, the people. Speaking of welcome back, we welcome back my buddy and yours, Mark Levine, an attorney, a talk show host, and my co-host here every Tuesday, hour two on the Inside Scoop edition on the Leslie Marshall Show. Mark is also as a former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank and the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees. And speaking of the Inside Scoop, that's the name of his radio and television show. The Raucous Caucus is also another show that he hosts on Pacifica Radio, and that's locally in the D.C. inside the Beltway, WPFW 89.3 FM, and you can catch him on TV on Fox, MSNBC, CNN, Fox Biz, and CNBC. Mark, thanks for holding. Welcome back, and thank you for sharing that bombshell and all.
My pleasure. I do want to point out, Lambda today is very supportive of gay rights, and I just don't think that they felt that it could be achieved what we in the community thought could be achieved, and it just shows you how far we've come in only 13 years.
Absolutely. Do you have more to say on that in a few minutes? You know, this is the smallest segment in the hour, or do you want to move on to the Guantanamo Bay strikers? Because we haven't talked about that issue in Gitmo yet, and I'm glad we're going to touch upon it tonight, but we do have another half hour after the break.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely looking forward to talking about Gitmo. I'm very concerned about how we are perceived around the world, and frankly, I've been opposed to what's happened in Guantanamo Bay all along. Last word on marriage equality is that, of course, that as much as I'm celebrating how far we've come, of course, it's still illegal in 37 states. Still, couples have difficulty with having their marriages recognized if they move from one state to another. The Defense of Marriage Act has not been completely struck down because the other part of it has to do with states recognizing other states' marriages. So this is an important point to celebrate, but I would argue it's halftime, and we still have the second half to go.
Because we almost have the second half of the show to go, I want to ask you, states to watch: New Jersey, Illinois, Oregon, Indiana, and Iowa, I believe?
Definitely New Jersey and Illinois and Oregon. Indiana may go in the other direction. They're looking to take Iowa in the other direction. But I think those are definitely states to watch. And I don't think Pennsylvania is too far away either. But I would argue New Jersey and Illinois, definitely the next ones around the corner.
Okay.
Hawaii, too, by the way. Good old Hawaii may come back.
Yeah, I think people forgot. I know that it's confusing because you could and then you couldn't, and it gets, I think it gets very confusing. It becomes like Scrabble, unfortunately, because this is not, these are not letters on a board. These are people's, or, you know, on a, whatever that you call that. Well, Scrabble is a board, but the thing that you hold it in, the holder on the wooden holder, these are people's lives for crying out loud. And I still amazes me. Amazes me in 2013 we can have this conversation. Well, speaking of, we're going to talk more with my co-host in this hour of the Inside Scoop edition of the Leslie Marshall Show, right here, hour two, every Tuesday. And we're going to talk when we come back about the strikers. Yes, there are strikers in Guantanamo, if you didn't know. Four prisoners on a hunger strike. We'll talk about that, or more than four, but a motion struck on behalf of four of them. We'll be back right after this. And we are back. I'm Leslie Marshall. My co-host in this hour, Mark Levine, former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank, House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees. Currently in D.C., he hosts the radio television show The Inside Scoop, and that is appropriate name because that's what the name of Hour 2 here on the Leslie Marshall Show is right now. Hour 2 every Tuesday with my co-host, Mark Levine, The Inside Scoop, right here. So pick up the phone in this hour, 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543, and we will talk, because we are going to touch upon actually what is going on in Guantanamo Bay. Mark, thank you for holding. Welcome back as my co-host in this and every Tuesday, hour two. Here, the Inside Scoop version of the show. Let's talk about first for people that aren't aware. I think I've mentioned it in Ripped. We've talked about doing it as a topic, and then all of a sudden, you know, it left the first page because of the front page of the news because everything was going on, and it pushed it to page four. But it's still very much ongoing. First of all, there is a hunger strike at Guantanamo Bay, and I know there was a motion that was filed on behalf of four prisoners. Are there just four prisoners involved in the hunger strike, and could you tell the listeners a bit about the hunger strike?
No, I believe there's some 40-something prisoners. There's about 160-something prisoners that are there. Actually, I take it back. 40 have been force-fed. 120 of the 160 are currently on a hunger strike. So three-quarters of them are on the hunger strike, and of those, a total of one-quarter of them, 40-something, are being force-fed. And let's face it, many of these detainees have been found not guilty. They've been found innocent. They've been found subject to release. The only reason they're not being released is because Congress passed a law that President Obama opposed that said that we have to hold these people indefinitely. We cannot try them. We cannot see exactly what they've done wrong. We simply have to hold them for life. In my opinion, that is a violation of the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment. It's a violation of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, which allow you to have due process. Look, if you've committed a crime in the United States, then try them, prove the crime,
yep,
and put them in prison. And I've long argued that. I argued that back when Bush opened it. One of the real problems Obama has is that he's having to clean up Bush's mess. When Bush sent the prisoners to Guantanamo Bay, it was illegal. In fact, the Supreme Court found that in the Hamdi case. He did it because he made this very strange argument that Guantanamo Bay is not U.S. soil, even though it's a permanent lease. So it's kind of weird. We have a permanent lease on this base in Cuba. We have it forevermore unless we give it back. But that loophole allowed Bush to say we have complete control over them, but they don't have any constitutional rights. And to me, that's Kafkaesque. Look, I'm not debating that some of these people may be very dangerous, but to me, the idea of indefinite detention is far more dangerous to American democracy and constitutional law than any of the crimes these people have committed. Bring them back to the United States, try the ones that are guilty, put them in jail, but the others, you got to let go.
Oh, most definitely. You know, it's ironic. Somebody on Twitter tweeted that, Leslie, you're pro-choice. It's their choice. And exactly, people don't, you know, understand this with regard to, because let's talk about what the lawsuit is surrounding. And that's surrounding, it isn't even surrounding this lawsuit, how these people are innocent, how they're
right,
still in prison. The hunger strike is to draw attention to that. And, you know, basically what the strike says is that the military, who have a practice and are using or trying to use this on the prisoners, and there are only four. And I do want to know, Mark, first, why is the motion only filed on behalf of four of the prisoners? Is the attorney just representing four of those 40, you know, a tenth of that hunger strike population? But the military has a practice of using a nasogastric tube to force feed striking prisoners with a liquid nutrient mix. And basically the lawsuit claims this is inhumane and violates medical ethics. I agree that it is inhumane and violates medical ethics. And that's just clearly, you can Google the medical ethics surrounding that. And therefore it is their choice.
The reason why these four have filed the motion is all four of these specific prisoners have been cleared for removal from Guantanamo Bay. So all four have been found by military judges that they haven't committed any crime or no crime worthy of detention, and basically they're innocent people. I'm not claiming everyone in Guantanamo Bay is innocent, but these four, we know that the military lawyers have found them to be innocent. So what's happening to them is worst of all. And there's just so much here. First of all, so three-quarters of them are on this hunger strike. And actually, you could argue, and I believe that if you go on a hunger strike, particularly because you're protesting inhumane treatment to draw attention to it, then you should be allowed even to die. I think you have a right to die. I don't think we have a right to force feed them and force them to live in this indefinite detention, this misery. If they died, they might achieve what they're trying to achieve, which is worldwide attention to this inhumane conduct. And furthermore, and this to me is really, really troubling. Ramadan is coming up. It is, of course, the month where Muslims fast during the day. They are allowed to eat after sundown. And to me, they have an absolute First Amendment right to fast, at least during the day. I guess you could make an argument that on the religious grounds, you could force feed them at night. I still don't think the force feeding is allowed because I think that violates cruel and unusual punishment. But certainly force feeding them during a holy day when they're not allowed to eat, to me, not only is inhumane, it's a violation of their religious freedoms as well. And it's a terrible, terrible precedent for the United States around the world. Why do we have to be seen as such an inhumane country? We don't have to be doing this. It doesn't help our security anyway. It just makes us look bad. And then we wonder why Muslims and others around the world hate us.
Mark or Zach, which one of you is IMing me saying that you want to... ZQ, sweetie, Zach, I know you wanted to chime in on this.
Yeah, I just want to say real quick, Mark, I guess wanted your take, and my own thoughts were that I understand, you know, if people are fasting and taking a stand against something that, you know, they're willing to I guess die for their beliefs and their cause here. But as long as someone prisoner or, you know, law abiding or what have you is under U.S. government care and supervision and watch, isn't it on us to, you know, make sure they're alive and at least decently taken care of?
You know, I do think that it is the obligation of people, jailers, as it were, to make sure that people are healthy when they want to be. In other words, if a prisoner is sick, you should give them the treatment to cure them. They break a leg, you set their leg, and so forth. But I think that these prisoners are not typical sick people. They are specifically trying to go on a fast in order to illustrate their condition. They are risking death, and I don't think we should prevent them from dying. Honestly, I think they have a right to die. Frankly, I think if they died, a few of them, it might just bring world attention to this. That's what they think. It's their choice. No, I really don't believe in force feeding them. If I felt that they were insane, someone was insanely refusing food and wasn't in their right mind, and was, you know, then there might be an argument for it. But these people are making, as far as I can see, a conscious, sane choice to starve themselves, and I think they should have the right to die.
Speaking of Zach, anything else, sweetie?
He said he's good.
Okay, sounds good. You know what? I wanted to ask you about that, Mark, but, you know, let's take some calls, and let's go to Paul in Raleigh, North Carolina. Paul, good evening. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Leslie. How are you guys doing?
Good. How are you doing tonight? What is your feeling about Guantanamo Bay and these prisoners, and these prisoners on a hunger strike being force-fed against not only law when it comes to, you know, medical ethics, but, you know, religious First Amendment freedoms?
I feel listening to Mark talk about that. Like, my feelings have gotten so mixed about this. One, I don't think they should be there. If they've been cleared for release, they should absolutely have been released a long time ago. And also, too, I mean, like, to play the devil's advocate here, you know, even if you buy the administration's argument that they're not on American soil and whatnot, don't the Geneva Conventions apply to prisoners of war? I mean, if we're using that as a basis for argument, I mean, they're technically prisoners of war if they're not prisoners of the United States for committing criminal violations. And if they are here for violating criminal acts against the United States, they should be subject to our laws, which would, you know, of course, provide them all the protections of our Bill of Rights.
I agree with you, Paul. And frankly, President Obama agrees with us, too. He did try to close Guantanamo Bay down. He's often criticized because he didn't succeed. But the main reason he didn't succeed is that Congress prevented him from succeeding. Mostly Republicans, but some Democrats, too, voted to in one of the appropriations bill to make sure that no funds ever went to transferring anyone from Guantanamo Bay. So basically,
right, they
prevented him from doing so. And unless a court orders it done, I don't know how we get these people out. We could pass another law, but Congress did it because the American people were brought to a frenzy. You know, oh my God, they have these horrible people on the streets. Well, they wouldn't be on the streets. They'd be in prison. If they're released because they're innocent, yeah, they'd be released. They could go home. Some of these people are probably guilty. Some of these people are probably guilty of heinous acts. But again, indefinite detention, that's something for Kafka. That's not something for the United States of America.
Right.
My country is better than that.
Don't we have to prove they're guilty of heinous acts, though? You know, I mean,
I agree. prove it beyond a
reasonable
doubt.
The burden of proof is on us to prove that they've done these things and not...
Exactly.
You know, and
one thing you
I
point out about
horrible.
Prisoners of war, you are correct that the Geneva Conventions, in the middle of a war zone, you are allowed to remove people from the war zone. In other words, you capture an enemy soldier, that he may not be guilty of anything other than shooting at your soldiers, but that's what you do in wartime, and you can capture him and remove him from the battlefield, because if you return him to the battlefield, obviously, he can shoot your soldiers again. But you still have to treat them humanely, and frankly, these soldiers, I mean, we're getting out of Afghanistan. There's almost no battlefield left, and so I'm not quite sure under what grounds we continue to hold them.
Well, the Geneva Conventions also state that soldiers, after the combat is ended, have to be repatriated to their country of origin.
That's correct.
So
the argument that's made is that the conflict is not over. But given the way the conflict has been defined as a war against terrorism, I'm not sure the conflict will ever be over. And that's a problem.
Horrendous. I mean, that's absolutely horrendous that we can define a conflict as something so broad as a war on terror, you know, and not a specific country. I mean, we've detained people from their countries of origin in a so-called war, and yet we can hold them forever. I find this shocking. It's not American.
I think it's unconstitutional, personally, and I've been surprised that the courts have allowed this to continue to happen. But we'll see where this lawsuit goes. The irony is, this lawsuit, as Leslie pointed out, isn't to free them; it's simply to allow them to basically slowly kill themselves in protest of not allowing them to have a fair trial.
You know, I think allowing them to die is horrible. I think we should release them before that ever comes to that point, because allowing innocent people to die is blatantly un-American.
Yeah, I agree.
It's not what we stand for. It's not what I stand for as an American. And the thought of allowing an innocent person to die in prison to prove a point is absolutely disgusting to me.
I agree with you, and the point is not that they're all this, and these four apparently are. Some of the others aren't, but, you know, our prisons are strong enough, and our courts are strong enough. One of the main reasons why some people didn't want to return them to the United States is because we had tortured at least three of them, and basically confessions that are gotten by torture are not allowed in U.S. courts for obvious reasons. This was all done in the Bush administration. Obama didn't know what to do with them. But even the vast majority of Guantanamo Bay inmates have not been tortured, so at least free those, and then we'll deal with the extreme moral difficulty of the ones we tortured later. But there's 166 people that are not being tried fairly according to the Constitution, and in my view, that is something that America will never live down. It reminds us of some of the other shameful events that we've done in our past. We can't undo the past, but we can definitely do something about the future. And this hunger strike is bringing attention to them. We haven't talked about Guantanamo Bay, at least I haven't on my show, for at least a year or two. So in a sense, I'm glad they're doing it, not because I want them to suffer, but because they're bringing attention to their cause.
All right.
You're a brilliant guy. I appreciate it.
He is, certainly. Paul,
thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Paul, and Raleigh from North Carolina. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this a little bit more. Also touch upon the Zimmerman trial. And I did have something to ask about DOMA to Mark. So when we come back, a lot more of that and a lot more with you here on the Inside Scoop version of the Leslie Marshall Show. Don't go away. Leslie Marshall. It is hour two of Tuesday. That means it is time for the Inside Scoop with me and my co-host, Mark Levine. Mark, thanks for holding. Welcome back. Lot to talk about. Let's finish up with the Guantanamo. Legally,
sure.
Mark, if I choose to, do I have the choice legally to not have a feeding tube? If I, you know, as a non-prisoner in the United States, and because these people, even though they're imprisoned, you know, these individuals, like you said, are not considered guilty. You know, so this is not, you know, they haven't been, you know, charged. There hasn't been, you know, a trial, a military tribunal to place them there for.
And half of them
crimes.
Have been cleared for release.
And cleared for release, absolutely.
Half of them have been.
Even more importantly, absolutely. So, like me, they should be a free person. And on paper, they technically, you know, have not committed, you know, a crime or not a criminal. So, and have not even been, you know, charged with a crime. So do I have the legal right to say I don't want a feeding tube? One. Two, does the First Amendment encompass them? Because they're cleared for release, but they were considered terrorist, right, as opposed to, you know, in placed in Guantanamo Bay in a different way than if I were processed in the United States. And three, do I legally have the right to kill myself? I know in the state of Oregon you do. So let's talk about that, because obviously Guantanamo Bay is not in a state.
Right. So Oregon is the only state in the United States I'm aware of that actually has a legal right to physician-assisted suicide. You know, laws in all 50 states prohibit suicide, but they're kind of, it's very hard to prevent you from jumping off a bridge or shooting yourself. So there's more on the books to help us prevent mentally ill people from killing themselves. People do reject feeding tubes all the time when they're in the hospital with terminally ill diseases. And that's a right, I believe, in every one of the 50 states. If you're terminally ill, if you're in pain, plenty of people who have a few weeks to live, you know, and maybe are in a coma, sometimes it's a decision the family makes. When you're very, very ill, no one would stop you from, in your right mind, you know, refusing a feeding tube. The real question is, what if you're not ill? I think we can all agree that if you're mentally ill, we should maybe force feed you, and if you're physically ill, you might have the right to refuse it yourself. But what if you're not ill at all? What if you just want to kill yourself? Well, usually people don't go through not eating, because unless they're incarcerated, they if they want to kill themselves, they find some way to do it. So it doesn't really come up much in the case law. I think it, actually you do have a human right if you are of sound mind, and it's, of course you have to make sure. That's why I'm very concerned about physician-assisted suicide in Oregon. You have to be absolutely sure it's the person's decision and not family pushing them and so forth. But just as a matter of human rights, you know, if life is so bad that that you want to kill yourself, the idea of forcibly feeding people in indefinite detention, it just strikes me as completely inhumane.
No, absolutely.
I don't know if that answers your question. It's a complicated legal question.
No, it absolutely does. What needs to happen now for these individuals who've been cleared for release to be released? Because you talked about the political cog in the wheel that took place in between that, in between them being cleared.
Well, again, 86 of the 166 have been cleared. So a little more than half have been cleared. That means that there's, you know, I don't know whether they're, quote, innocent, unquote, or not, but there's certainly not enough evidence to pursue a crime, and police let people go all the time when there's not evidence to pursue a crime. There are political considerations. The Republicans claim if we release these people, they're going to do terrorist acts. That may or may not be true. Of course, given how they've been treated, there's an argument to be made that we so mistreated them that now we may have turned innocent people into terrorists, which is a really frightening concept. But at the end of the day, our laws say you can't hold people without a reason under the law. And President Obama would like to release them. The Republicans in Congress, as I said, passed a law prohibiting it. The only way to get them out now would be a Supreme Court ruling, which I think may happen, or Congress has to change its laws and allow these people, you know, have to be tried and have to be released.
I wanted to ask about DOMA. It bothered me that Bill Clinton originally, as was president and had signed that into law, the Defense of Marriage Act, defining marriage between a man and a woman. I was very surprised by that, because the Clintons are both, not just Hillary, but Bill Clinton, in support of gay rights and gay marriage. And she came out and said as much. And after the rulings, you know, made a comment not just for herself, but for former President Clinton. Were you surprised that somebody who seemed to hold those views even then would have signed the Defense of Marriage Act? I mean, I know you're a Democrat. I mean, are you angry and blame the guy? You got to do this in 60 seconds.
a lot of people were angry and blamed him in 1996. I think most of us understood that he was doing it solely for re-election. I think both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, frankly, always supported marriage equality. They took the opposite position, not because they believed it, but because they knew at that point in time the majority of American people were against it. They did it solely for political reasons. Sorry, they're politicians. But I don't think it's where their heart was. I'm not justifying it. I'm explaining it.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate that. We will see you and hear from you and talk to you again as my co-host here on the Inside Scoop edition of the Leslie Marshall Show next Tuesday, hour two. Same bat time, same bat channel every Tuesday, hour two. Be sure to follow Mark at Mark Levine Talk. Also go to www.marklevinetalk.com. I'm Leslie Marshall. Hour three straight ahead.